The message this morning is about renewing marriage. And it's really a message to all of the young married couples in our parish and to all those who might be listening on the radio. If you've only been married 4 months, then you may or may not already be the one that this is directed to. Saw an article talking about millennials. You know how you got baby boomers? They were born in a certain time. Well, millennials are the 20-somethings. That's how they're referring to them, the millennials. And so they did a survey looking at how they think about traditional values. And they were surprised to find that 94% respect parenthood and 84% had great esteem for marriage. Just a quarter said that they respected Hollywood, who, of course, is always against marriage and parenthood and all that kind of stuff. Spokesman for the agency said that she was surprised by the findings. It could be because they are more idealistic as a generation, but Mark Johnson, another guy that was part of the study, said that he believes that the 20-somethings are reacting to how they were raised. That at least half of them that we see have come out of some kind of dysfunctional or broken home, and they are wanting something more or better than they have come from. It's a reaction to parents who never got through phase two of their marriage. And so now you'll have to listen and hear what I'm talking about. We've had several weddings here in the last few years, and you just watch the folks that are planning the wedding, and I mean, they are so excited. They are so euphoric. They're anticipating the greatest moment of their life. I mean, you know, after this, we're going to live happily ever after, right? That kind of the feeling before marriage. But somewhere during the first 15 years of marriage, sometimes it begins at year one for some a little earlier, some it doesn't set in until about year 10, but you know, somewhere in there, in that first 15 years of marriage, all of a sudden there comes a time when it doesn't look quite so rosy anymore. What happens after the new wears off? What happens when the resentments start to build up? What happens when you discover that they actually have flaws and foibles? And that cute little thing that they used to do that you thought was so cute, all of a sudden it's not cute anymore. It really gets on your nerves when they do that. And you wish they could just grow up or chill out or back off or stop being a spectator and start helping around the house or start helping bring in some money. I mean, something, right? And then what happens when the love starts to grow cold towards your spouse? That's what I'm talking about, is that this starts happening in every marriage somewhere between year 1 and year 15. And when that starts to happen, most of us think that there's something wrong with us or that there's something wrong with our marriage. We're certain by that point that there's something wrong with our spouse, okay? I mean, we have come to the conclusion that for sure there's something wrong with them and that somehow they, and maybe we are contributing to messing up our marriage. You know, we start wondering, what's happening? And some folks are ashamed about it, and so they just kind of pull in themselves and they won't let anybody know what's going on. Others go just the opposite, and that's the only thing they talk about is how rotten their marriage is, and they run their friends off because nobody wants to hear about it anymore. Let me tell you what's happening at this point. When it seems like your marriage is coming to an end, when you finally get to this place where it seems like you're stuck in what's going to be a miserable situation for the rest of your life, I have good news for you. That means that you have entered into the process of truly becoming one flesh. I mean, you thought that you had started becoming one flesh during the joys of your wedding night, right? I mean, that was an important start, and it begins the first phase of marriage, the honeymoon phase. That's the fun part. But phase one is just the beginning of the marriage. And now that you've discovered there are problems in your marriage, you've started phase two. And that's the part where you're actually becoming one flesh. Okay? Now, some folks here, like the Boguas, they've kind of gotten through phase two. Debbie and I have gotten through phase two. You really haven't started being married until you get to phase two. And that's when you start working on really becoming one flesh. That's when the hard work really starts. And listen to me, hopefully the joys of your wedding night will help carry you through phase two, if you know what I mean. It will help carry you through the turbulent time, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. But anyway, you got some hard work ahead, and the length of time that it takes to get through this phase of marriage depends to some extent on how hard you work, but mostly it depends on how smart you work. And I want to help give you some tips today and maybe next Sunday to help you work through these things. I mean, there are a lot of things you can do to prolong the agony of these years. Debbie and I have a long list of things that we did that are guaranteed to prolong the anguish and the agony for a long time. And I can tell you, those are some things you probably don't want to do. And so we'll get into some of those things. I hope to save some of you some heartache and to show you some of the things that can shorten this process and that can help you get safely and quickly to phase three. Now, what I call phase three of the marriage is where you're living life and enjoying it, because you weren't enjoying it during phase two, I can assure you of that. If you hear nothing else this morning, I want you to hear that every marriage has a phase one, almost by definition, the honeymoon, right? Every marriage has a phase two. That's where problems start happening and you move into this place of being pressed together and ground into one flesh. The sad part is that some marriages never get through phase two. In other words, there doesn't have to be a phase three in a marriage. And all of us know people who are still stuck 40 or 50 years later in phase two of their marriage, and they still don't get along, or they've just become roommates. And I want to try to save you from that. And also want to try to shorten that period that phase two takes. Going through the phase two of a marriage is a totally natural, normal process, okay? If you don't go through some kind of difficulties in becoming one flesh, then you're definitely an exception. You're like one in a million, one in 100 million. I mean, it just doesn't happen. Everybody goes through this. And it's normal, and you're going to make it through it, hopefully, if you'll just be patient and listen up, and I can save you, hopefully, years of heartache. In other words, submit to the process. Don't fight it. It's a normal process. Fighting it or ignoring it, or denying that you're in that kind of difficulty, those things just slow down your progress, that's all. It just makes sure you stay there longer. And if you're not there yet, if you're scratching your head wondering, what's he talking about? We're still in the honeymoon. Just trust me, you'll get there eventually, okay? And remember this sermon, and remember then to ask for the tape, and I'll be sure and give it to you. The question is not if you're going to go into the phase two becoming one flesh difficult part of the marriage. The question is, when will it start and how long will you stay there? That's the only questions there are. Now, the place I want to start this morning, and I've got some practical hints and guides to give you, and we may not get to a lot of those until next Sunday, but the place I want to start is with the structure of the family, because that's really what's happening in phase two. We're bringing together the godly structure of the family, and there's a lot of conflict in doing that. The biblical structure of the family is described to us in 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 9. And we're going to go through those in a minute. I want to kind of summarize, give you an overview of the biblical structure of the family. A man and a woman come together in holy matrimony and they become one flesh, okay? And that one flesh relationship becomes the ruling or the governing head of the family. The parents, the mom and dad, that's the ruling of the family. Kids eventually come along, and initially, of course, they're completely under the control or the rule or the authority of the parents. They may not appreciate that, but they are. But as they mature and the parents begin to train them and they move toward becoming adults, well, then more and more you begin to give them responsibility and you begin to give them more freedom to either succeed or fail. And eventually, they leave the house and they start their own family. Well, while the children are in the house, while they're under daddy's roof, they certainly have a say in what the family does, and they certainly have a right to express their own opinions. And as they get older, their desires, of course, they can carry more weight in family decisions. But I'll tell you, generally, they're under the rule of the parents. The parents may listen to what they have to say, but whatever the parents say, that's what the family does. And they just have to get used to that idea that whatever mom and dad says, well, that's what we're going to do. And if mom and dad say, well, we're going to move to Arizona, well, then that's what you do. You know, the kids don't go, oh, well, I don't want to go. I like my friends here. And the parents go, oh, okay, well, we'll stay. No, that's not the way it works. The parents are in charge, okay? They should be. That's the biblical structure, I think, that the ruling unit is the parents. And this is tough because it's an ordered relationship of equals. The husband and the wife are completely equal in Christ. They're completely equal as human beings. But the husband is the head of the house, even though he's no better than his wife or no worse than his wife, because they're equals, but he still has this functional position as being the head. It's not about, I'm bigger and better than you are. It's about, I've just got a different job than you have. And God has given us that job. Us men in the house, we've been appointed by God to be the head of the house. And so what that means is that the head of the house is primarily, not exclusively, but he's primarily responsible for the well-being of the family. And he's primarily responsible for being the chief servant of the needs of the family. You understand what I'm saying? This is God's structure for authority, is the one who's primarily responsible is the servant of all. And so, guys, you know, we talk about our home is our castle. Yeah, that's the castle where I serve. I'm the chief servant of the whole place. I am responsible for serving the entire family. I'm primarily responsible for the financial health of the family. I'm primarily responsible for taking care of the wife and kids, providing for them. I am primarily responsible as the head of the house for the spiritual leadership and the spiritual health of the family. But I'm not the only one responsible for the spiritual health of the family. Mama is too. I'm primarily responsible for the direction and the purpose of the family. I'm primarily responsible to guide and to govern the family, to establish the rule of the family, to establish the discipline, the government of the family. So the husband may be primarily responsible for all these things about the family, but if the wife isn't involved, then the leadership of the family won't be effective. It won't be godly leadership. The husband and the wife have to be involved together and come together in agreement and consensus at least as much as possible, okay? Like, for instance, how are you going to discipline the children? Does one person decide that? Does daddy decide that by himself? Does mom decide that by herself? Hopefully not. I mean, what's too soft in discipline? What's too harsh in discipline? When and how might we spank our children? Well, daddy always tends to be more of a disciplinarian, right? Mom tends to be more of a nurturer, and you need both. But you got to come to agreement somehow so that you're not working at cross purposes with each other. Nothing is worse for a kid than dad says, don't you dare do that. And then mom turns around and says, oh, here, hon, you can do that. It's okay. I mean, that'll kill you. Kill the family. So you've got to be able to come into agreement. See, I understand this concept of the headship is kind of a dual thing in the family. It's the parents of the family. You have to decide who's going to handle the day-to-day finances of the house, make sure bills get paid. These are all the practical things that start to bring up this phase two part of the marriage, this part of the marriage where you start to have conflicts and issues with, I don't think this is working very well. What church are we going to make our church home? Where are we going to live? And what kind of car are we going to own? How much should we set aside of our money, and how can we make our money work for us? How's the labor around the house going to be divided between the man and the wife? Who's going to do the laundry and wash the dishes and carry out the trash and do the vacuuming? I mean, these are all the kinds of issues that start coming up in becoming one flesh. And most of them are traumatic and difficult. That is, they're not the first year or two because, you know, there's so much glow from the start of the marriage and the honeymoon that everybody's so excited. Oh, sure, dear, whatever you want. But after a while, it's like, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't think I ought to have to do that. I mean, after all, and we start getting into this mode of what our rights are and who's doing what and who's not doing what. And that's when we sort of get to the place where we realize, oh, maybe this isn't as easy as I thought it was going to be. See, the idea is that all of the things about how we're going to work together as a ruling unit of the family, the husband and wife have to come to agreement in those things in consensus. And then they have to hold each other accountable for that agreement. You may actually have to set aside specific times. There's a lot of things I'm going to talk about in getting through phase two that you have to do on purpose. You don't do it because it just happens. You don't do it because it feels good. You do it because you have decided that you're going to do some things and you're going to do them on purpose. I'll give you a little preview. For instance, you may need to decide on purpose you're going to set aside some time for cuddling or for kissing. I mean, you know, first year or two of marriage, everybody's like, hey, you can't get enough of that. But, you know, when phase two sets in, all of a sudden it's like, ooh, don't touch me. And you're going to have to, on purpose, change some of that stuff. Well, one of the on-purpose things you may have to do is say, we need to talk about some things and see if we can come into consensus and come into agreement on some things. And you may have to pick one subject, and it may take a while to think about it. And I'll tell you how we come to consensus in the church is we don't argue about this stuff a lot. We don't do the pros and cons a lot. We spend a lot of time praying together and seeing what we hear the Lord say. And I suggest that in the family, if the husband and wife can do that, pray together and hear what they think the Lord is saying, that they'll be able to come to agreement and come to consensus much more easily about things. So if the husband and wife are supposed to come to agreement by consensus on the government and ruling the house and how a house is supposed to be run, then how is it that the man is the head of the house? When does he get to exercise his authority and tell everybody else what to do? Huh? When she lets him. When does he get to be boss, huh? Well, I mean, actually, he's always boss since he's the one ultimately responsible. But I'm not talking about the responsible part. I'm talking about the authority part, right? When does Dad get to act like boss and throw his weight around and make everybody do what Dad wants, right? When does he get to tell his wife she's got to do whatever he says, she's got to obey him? Well, actually, the man of the house does have the final decision. And that's really the place where the man begins to exercise authority is when you're coming together in consensus and in agreement and you can't come into agreement. And yet a decision has to be made. It's not something you can wait on. Then the man has the final authority. He has the tiebreaker authority and responsibility in the family. He's been assigned that role and it's the ultimate authority. But also when he does that, he bears full responsibility for whatever his decision is. And if it's a bad decision, the weight of that is all on his shoulders. And as a matter of fact, there have been a lot of women that have said, well, I can't let him make a decision. He's too immature. He's too stupid. He's too whatever he is. I can't let him make those decisions. This is too important. We've got to have the right decision. And of course, I know what the right decision is and he doesn't. And so therefore, I'm just going to force whatever decision I want. And that's what we're going to do. I'm going to keep kicking at him until we do. But you know, since he bears the full responsibility of that, ladies, what you can do is just turn that over to the Lord and say, Lord, he's yours. It's his problem, not my problem. When he does the stupid thing instead of the right thing, then he's the one that's going to bear the responsibility. I'm not bearing the responsibility because I'm being obedient to your word. I am submitting myself to my husband's authority. Debbie and I went through some of this phase two kind of stuff where Debbie was certain we ought to be doing things one way, and I was certain we ought to be doing things another way. And Debbie would sometimes, the longer we got into phase two and the more we became one flesh, the more Debbie was able to say, okay, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you make that decision. I'm going to let you do what you think is right, and I will go along with that. And I'm going to pray that the Lord will change your heart if you're not doing it right, and change my heart if I'm in the wrong. And I'm going to pray that God protect you from the full brunt of the responsibility of your stupid decision. I mean, this was kind of the way some of those conversations went, you know. But that's the practicality of how it works, okay? We're not talking about pie in the sky somewhere. We're not talking about Prince Charming and Snow White. We're talking about real people that really do have to learn to get along for the rest of our lives. And this is the process of learning that. You can come together in consensus and in agreement, but a lot of times you can't. Or sometimes you come together in agreement and consensus. Oh, we are certain this is the way we're supposed to do it. And then one party goes off and does exactly that, and the other one goes off and works the other direction. You know, I am certain that, I don't know, let's pick something. I am certain that the kids should never go out of the house without their shoes on. And boy, the mom and dad agree completely. Okay, they're always going to have their shoes on when they go out of the house. And so every time they go out of the house, Dad's checking them. You got your shoes on, got your shoes on, got your shoes on. He sees them out in the yard playing, shoes off. You come in here and get your shoes on. You got to have your shoes on all the time. And after a few weeks, Mom is letting them go out of the house without their shoes on. She sees them outside, they don't have their shoes on. She doesn't do anything about it. You know, dad's supposed to come to mom and say, hey, I thought we had agreement on this. We hold each other accountable to what we agree to. Okay, that's okay to do that. That makes sense? Now, it's right in the middle of figuring out who the boss is and how that thing is going to work that we usually arrive at phase two in our marriage, this becoming one flesh, difficult, traumatic phase, especially when things get tough. Or a bad decision was made, or appears to have been made, or appears to maybe is about to be made. I'm sure Debbie thought that one day when I came home and said, I've quit my job because this guy's cheating people and I'm just not going to be part of that. And I suspect Debbie at that point was certain I had made a wrong decision, okay? Or sometimes it's tough because one person is not willing to step into the role of leadership of the family. Or you have somebody that wants to take over and boss everybody else around. Or you can't agree on how to discipline the children or how to handle the finances. Or, well, of course I can have a bass boat and that old couch you got, I don't care if it falls apart. I want my bass boat. I mean, you know, when those kind of things start happening, that's when you know you're in the middle of this phase too, and those things are going to have to be worked out and resolved. Now, I think I'm going to shift gears, and I'm going to do something a little bit different. Turn to 1 Corinthians 7. Now, for those listening on the radio, if children are listening, kids who are not yet out of high school and older than 5 or 6, you may want to get them out of the room now, because I'm about to talk about intimacy in marriage, and I'm probably going to do it in a fairly blunt way. And so there may be some kids that this would not be an appropriate discussion for, and so you may want to turn the radio off for about the rest of this message, next 4 or 5 minutes. 1 Corinthians 7, because this is one of the things that begins to happen when we get into phase two of our marriage. We start withholding our affection from one another and our intimacy. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also his wife to her husband. What do you think he's talking about when he says, fulfill your duty to the husband and wife? He's talking about having sex. That was the subject of the previous chapter, and he is just continuing that in the context of marriage. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Boy, how much against modern teaching is that? I mean, the modern teaching is, hey, this is my body, and I can do whatever I want to with my body. And Paul is saying, you know what? If you're in a one-flesh relationship, it ain't like that. Paul goes on, stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and then after that, come back together again, lest Satan tempt you because your lack of self-control. Now, I know that doesn't sound very spiritual, but this is what Paul is talking about here. You need to have sex if you're married. Now, unfortunately, there's a whole group of our society that has kind of turned sex into a recreational event or sport or something, and they have completely lost sight of the holy, intimate, wonderful nature of sex that God meant it to be in marriage. And so they've turned it into something without commitment, without any holiness, without any real value to it, and they're suffering from it. I mean, they talk about how unfulfilling it is and how they feel trapped by the way they're acting. A lot of college students have been in a lot of surveys talking about these kind of things. And it's kind of like, well, of course it's not going to be very fulfilling. It's not supposed to that way. God intended people to come together in holy matrimony, in wedding. We're supposed to have sex in front of God. I'm telling you, it's supposed to be a godly thing. This is the way the Bible presents it. It's not just two people coming together as animals. We're in the sight of God. It's a holy, wonderful thing. All the other animals, the only time they get together for sex is when the female is in heat, and that's the only time she'll allow the male near her. Otherwise, the male's going to get his nose bit off. I mean, you know, she is not going to allow this kind of stuff. If I'm not ready to have babies, we ain't doing it. Human beings aren't like that. We're the only mammals that God made that can enjoy sex when it's not related to procreation. And that's because we need that for our relationship. We need that, among other things, to get us through phase two of our marriage. But unfortunately, a lot of folks, when the marriage starts getting difficult and the resentments begin to build up and the anger begins to build up and the you're not doing right and you're not doing right, and all of a sudden people begin to withdraw themselves. You had a baby or two and it's, you know, we're all busy and it's not convenient. And pretty soon the marriage becomes a sexless marriage. And, you know, as a pastor, I get to see and understand these things. You'd be surprised how many older couples, 40 and older, are living as roommates together. And it's a sad thing. God never intended for that to happen. But what happens was they got in phase two, and they got into the resentments and into the, we're having difficulty in our marriage. And so they separated themselves from one another. Paul says, don't do that. You may have to, on purpose, make dates so that you don't do that. And then, of course, the enemy's going to come along and try to sabotage that, you know. And he's going to try to get y'all to pick a fight with one another so that you can't come together. I'm telling you, God made the beauty and the wonder of the honeymoon to give us that chance to learn about each other and learn how to enjoy each other and learn how to enjoy each other's bodies so that we could be carried through phase two. Otherwise, you get stuck in phase two, and especially if you separate yourselves from each other, you get stuck in phase two and you'll never get through it. So, that makes sense? Anybody understand what I'm talking about? I know this is a little graphic, but the subject of all this is renewing your marriage. And if you're going to renew your marriage, you're going to have to be intimate with one another. You're also going to have times where you're touching each other and cuddling together. Now, not for sex, but just, and guys, you're going to have to find some time to kiss your wife. You know, what happens is the guys and the women, especially during the dating and the honeymoon phase, everybody seems to like kissing a lot. But the longer you're married, enjoying kissing doesn't go away with the women, it seems like. But with the guys, it kind of goes away after a while. So maybe on purpose, you may have to kiss your wife and mean it. Yeah, here we go. You're going to be tempted to withdraw. You're going to be tempted to withdraw from each other. You're going to be tempted not to touch each other. You're going to be tempted not to talk civilly to each other. You're going to be tempted not to be intimate with each other. Remember the Lord's Prayer? Lord, lead us away from temptation. This is one of those temptations. You need to pray, Lord, lead us away from this temptation so that we won't fall into this pit, because that's exactly what it'll be. It'll be a pit that drags you down. Now, I know that wasn't very spiritual, but I think I'll stop there. And then next week, we're going to continue with some of the obstacles to renewing your marriage. And we'll also talk about the basic structure, but obstacles like built-up hostilities, obstacles like immaturity that you have brought into the marriage with you, obstacles like you've lost your life as you ever knew it, and now what are you going to do? I'll explain that next week.